Between the Lines
with Sarah McInerney.
This is News Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Lines with Sarah McInerney. Every Saturday morning on this programme, we're going to be taking a closer look at some of the main stories and issues of the week. We have lots to come over the next hour. It's the first week back for RTDs after their lengthy summer holidays. So what do they achieve? And will this be the term that the government finally sheds its reputation for running a do-nothing doll? Also, Naomi McElroy will be here for her take on some of the week's culture and media matters. But to start, we're joined this morning by Eoin Murphy, Minister for Housing, Planning and Local Government. Minister Murphy, thank you very much for coming into us.
Good morning.
So, you're three months in the job, a little over 3 months in the job. And over the last 3 months, there's been quite a lot of criticism that Simon Coveney should never have left the job, that he took a year reading himself into the brief to get to grips with what is a very complex and difficult problem, and that it would have been better for the country if Simon Coveney had stayed where he was. What do you make of that?
Well, Simon put in place an excellent plan in rebuilding Ireland to help us deal with the challenges that we're facing, not just in trying to build more houses, but making sure we're building more social houses, making sure we're fixing the rental sector, and making sure we're putting in enough supports for emergency accommodation. That plan, Rebuilding Ireland, was entrusted to me to review it 1 year on to see what might be improved, what additional things that we could do 1 year further on from our recession with a new government and with renewed ambition. And I've been doing that over the past 3 months. Simon now has a very important job in relation to Brexit, and he's doing that very well.
Are you not starting from scratch, though?
No, not at all, because we have an excellent foundation in rebuilding Ireland. We have, not to get into the technicalities of the plan and to bore people about the five pillars and the different things that we want to do, but if, for example, you look at the fast-track planning process, whereby if you were building more than 100 houses or apartments, or more than a student accommodation with more than 200 units, you could bring that straight to An Bord Pleanála. So someone like Simon would have done a lot of the preparatory work around that. But when I came into office, I was able to then sign those orders into effect. We now have that process in place, and there are somewhere in the region of 5,000 units currently on the books of An Bord Pleanála waiting for fast-track approval. If you look at, say, for example, we had a number of people building houses who needed a second extension to their planning permission because they might have commenced when the recession happened. And they would have had the first 5 years. And if you look at where we are in our historical cycle, they were about to run out of permission. They needed a second extension. Again, preparatory work would have been done on that before I came into office. I came into office, I was able to then take that work, put it into legislation and fast track it to the Dáil before the recess so that people didn't have to stop building houses over the summer and apply for new planning permission. So there's always continuity in government. Ministers change. It's one of the functions of a democracy. And when they do change, the important thing to do is to make sure that you have those that vision, that policy framework in place so that a new minister can come in, like myself, work that framework, but also then take a second look at it to see, well, what could be done differently to help improve it here? Because we should always be reviewing policy. We shouldn't just publish a document and ignore it. We should have a rolling analysis, and that's what we're doing at the moment.
Sure, and I think most people would agree that it's good to review policy, but maybe not after a year, maybe not before most of those policies haven't even had a chance to bed in or be implemented in some cases. I mean, in a lot of cases, you're not reviewing, you're coming up with whole other ideas. You've come up with the Fair Deal scheme idea, for example. You're looking at the Help to Buy scheme. You're reviewing that whether or not it hasn't even been in for a year.
Well, no, not necessarily, because Help to Buy was always going to be reviewed because Michael Noonan had flagged that when he brought it through with the budget last year. If you look at things around the Fair Deal, that was part of the vacancy strategy that was there. So when I came in, there was a vacancy strategy that had been prepared. I felt it could be more ambitious. So we started to look at other possible streams, types of accommodation that could come into vacancy. But if you look at something like the Repair and Lease scheme, which again is another vacancy measure, which hasn't worked at all, we shouldn't be waiting any longer to change that scheme. So it's good that we were able to take a look at it when I came in and say, well, this is what's wrong and this is now how we're going to fix it. And I'll be announcing that in a couple of weeks about the changes that we're making there. So we should always be analysing things. We obviously want some certainty as well. So you don't want to be changing everything, but you can see where you can tweak a thing. So, for example, if we had said that maybe the fast track planning process should only apply to developments for houses of 200 or more, and if by this stage we hadn't had the volume that we had anticipated, we could have tweaked that down. The fundamentals would still be there, a fast track for planning permission, but then you would maybe kind of tweak it around the edges. So that's the kind of thing that you want to be doing. You don't want to be making fundamental changes. But if you look even again under Rebuilding Ireland, if you look at our social housing project, we were buying in the market. We were competing against other people trying to buy their first homes, their new homes. That was driving up prices, and it was excluding someone else from buying a home. 1 year on now from Rebuilding Ireland, 1 year on because of the changes that have happened in the market and changes in the economy, I was able to say, well, actually, we should spend that money building new houses. So at the end of the housing summit that we had recently, I was able to announce that change. And as a result, we'll build 30% more new social housing homes next year.
Was so Fine Gael the last to the party on the fact that building new houses was the way to go?
No, because,
I mean, were you the last people to realise it in the country?
But we've been, the whole plan is about building. It's all about new supply. And
but you've just said you made a change there instead of trying to buy up housing stock.
We went from 3,000 to 3,800. So we were already building 3,000, which was way up on the 500 or so that were built in 2015. So a huge improvement, but we could improve it even further.
90,000 on the list.
90,000 are on the list. And how
3,800 is something that's being announced as an achievement ambition.
It's progress. You can't deny that it's progress on 500 houses built. But as we do with the housing list, it's not just about completely new builds. It's also about using the housing assistance payment and the private market as well. And we have, over the course of the Rebuilding Ireland plan, we're going to deliver at least 47,000 new social housing homes into the market for people on the housing list. But we'll continue to build beyond that plan. One of the things, and we've been talking about a rights-based approach to this policy, to all policies this week, is a principle-based approach, that you would talk about there always being a certain percentage of the market of new builds every year being built by the state in social housing. So that even when we go beyond the finance, the money that I have in the capital plan until 2021, that we'll see those 47,000 houses built, that we would always have, say, maybe 20% of new houses every year being built as social housing homes. Next year, it'll probably be a quarter.
Minister, that sounds great for the future.
But and it's happening next year. One quarter of houses built next year will be social housing homes.
3,800 houses are going to be built next year. There's 90,000 on the waiting list. This is a problem that has been burgeoning and in the works since 2011. You've had people telling you
it's a much
this
older
is
problem
an issue.
Our problem with our housing market
is much
older than
that. I'm saying 2011 because that's when Fine Gael had a chance to change it. That's when Fine Gael got into government.
When we were in
a
bailout.
That's when he had a chance.
When we were spending one-third in terms of our outgoings over what we were getting in taxation. Our initial job that we had to do was to fix the economy, to balance the books. This year, we will balance the budget for the first time in 10 years. What we've been able to do over the last number of years, as we've been able to take in more money from the extra jobs that have been created and the taxes that those people are paying, is then direct that into programs like those voids. So people often complain about the amount of social housing voids that are there because the council's not preparing them.
We've been told by this government and by the previous government as well for years now, Alan Kelly as Minister for the Environment, one of your predecessors, money isn't a problem, he said. We've got loads of money, we're putting loads of money into it. It still wasn't being done.
But this is the point where we're at now, that next year 20,000 new homes will be built. That's a conservative number between private and public.
Do you accept that Fine Gael in government has failed, though? Because it's fine saying this is the point we're at now and now we're going to start building and now we're going to start committing to building a certain amount every year regardless of what happens. That's fine. But let's take a look at what has happened.
Every
and do you accept that Fine Gael in government has failed to provide social housing for this country? And as a result of that, it has greatly increased the severity of the housing crisis faced by the country.
We have recovered the economy to a point where we're actually able to now make the investments that we need to make every year. And we have been doing for a number of years. So, for example, this year, every working day of the week, 80 new tenancies will be supported through social housing supports. That's new tenancies every working day of the week. That's a significant thing.
But again, housing and the way you speak about housing, and it's not just you, it's the way the government has spoken about housing for quite a long time, you speak in certain phrases. So you say 80 new tenancies will be supported. That's not 80 new houses that will be built, that's 80 new tenancies will be supported.
Yeah.
Okay, so some of those tenancies will involve houses that have been taken out of the private rental stock to provide houses for people who are on the social housing waiting list, which is great for the people on the social housing waiting list, but it's not good for the people in the private rental stock who now have a smaller supply of houses that they can actually rent and therefore rents go up. So you're helping one problem and making another problem worse. And the reason you're doing that is because the supply isn't there. And the reason the supply isn't there is because Fine Gael hasn't built the supply. Well, you haven't focused on it, you haven't prioritised it.
It absolutely has been a priority. Last year we repurposed the Department of Environment into the Department of Housing to bring rebuilding
Ireland. Last year you realised there's a housing problem.
No, but this has been building for a number of years, but a huge amount of work had been done. But absolutely we had to put a renewed focus to make sure that we could get both the private side and the public side to deliver what we need. Yes, those 80 new tenancies every working day of the week will be delivered through some acquisitions, so that policy is now changing. Also through voids, which are old social housing homes that have been vacant for too long, coming back into use. Also through the private rental sector and also through new builds. We think, from our advice from the housing agency, that we need to be building 25,000 homes a year. Next year, 20,000 are going to be built. This is coming after only 7 years ago, the property sector completely collapsed, and a decision even longer than that, where we outsourced our social housing responsibilities to the private sector. We as Fine Gael and government are taking those responsibilities back, and we are getting houses built on the social side, the public side, and on the private side as well. And we will see that. We'll see it this year, and we're going to see it next year as well.
Right, and I do want to talk about the future. I don't want to put too much pressure on you in terms of talking about the past, because you're only in your role for, as I say, just over 3 months. But I am interested in your view on one of the things that Fine Gael in government did in the last government, in terms of allowing or standing by, or indeed actively encouraging, in Michael Noonan's case, NAMA to sell vast tracts of Irish land to vulture funds without any development clause, without any requirement that these vulture funds would have to build at any time on those lands. So that we now have a situation where we have vast tracts of Irish land owned by foreign companies. I don't really care that they're foreign or that they're not Irish, but they have no obligation to build in them. Vast tracts of land in this country, empty, with no obligation to build in them, and indeed tax incentives for those companies not to build in them. And Fine Gael and government actively encouraged NAMA to do this.
Well, there's no tax incentives for them not to build on the land, but there is a vacant site levy that from the beginning of next year.
Which you've been talking about for years.
But we had to give time to let people to get planning permission and to start building on those sites. And we know that does take some time.
And hasn't happened.
The lead-in time had to be from 2018, the 1st of January. That's when we'll start the register for the vacant sites, and the levy will apply retrospectively from 2019. At the moment, I'm in discussions with the Attorney General as to what we might be able to do around the vacant site levy to make it more robust. And I hope to make an announcement on that shortly.
From 3% to 5% is what is being discussed.
I'm in discussions with the Attorney General as to how we can make that site levy more robust and more meaningful. We don't want people hoarding land. We want people building. And
right.
The Taoiseach has
so
also
if you want people building,
can,
why was there no development clause put on vast, vast tracts of Irish land that was sold to companies which are not development companies? They're vulture funds. They're companies that come in and buy an asset when it's at its lowest so they can
different
sell it
types
off.
Of, different types of investors have bought different assets under NAMA. Some have been international institutional investors who have come in, bought land, built on that land. That land is now in use, be it either for commercial or for residential purposes. Others have bought land, have developed part of it, but not all of it. We'd like to see them develop more. And others have held land. We know that. NAMA's primary function was to redeem for the Irish taxpayer the $32 billion in debt that it had taken on their shoulders to make sure that we weren't $32 billion worse off than we are now. It has been successful in achieving that mandate. What the Taoiseach announced very recently is...
Was Michael Noonan's job as finance minister, or Alan Kelly's job perhaps, or the Taoiseach's job and Kenny's job at the time, not to also protect the future of Irish land and development of Irish housing stock at a time when you were being told by developers, by economists, that we're facing a housing shortage? Who was the custodian of Irish land to say, hold on a second, let's not sell off land to people or to large companies who have no interest in developing that land?
No one in 2011 was talking about a housing shortage. We had ghost estates and we had problems with how we were going to deal with those ghost estates and the problems that we had. No one in 2011 was predicting the kind of employment return and economic recovery that we said we would deliver. They said it wasn't going to be possible. As a result of some of those great successes that we've had, as a result of the hard work the Irish people have put in, we now find ourselves with certain capacity constraints in the economy when we look at it as a whole. And we know, or we believe, that there may be a role for NAMA now that it finishes this mandate to see how we can get more supply into
plan?
The market.
NAMA as a housing agency, how far along is that?
We've been having discussions on this for the last 2 to 3 months, almost as soon as I was in office. So we are working on that at the moment.
So when can we expect to see
NAMA
start?
Well, NAMA comes under the Minister for Finance, so it'll be for the Minister for Finance to make the final decisions and make those announcements when he thinks it's the most appropriate time.
Budget?
It's for the Minister for Finance to make that call, Sarah, as to when it's the proper time.
Well,
but work is being done at the moment.
We heard it from the Taoiseach just a couple of weeks ago, or not even a couple of weeks ago. What was it, last week, that the Taoiseach announced that this is something that's being looked at? I mean, how serious is it? Is it just something that's being looked at, or is it something that's going to happen?
No, it's been looked at seriously. There's been a lot of speculation as to whether there might be a role for NAMA as it finishes its current mandate. And so we're looking at what that role may be.
On a broader scale, because I want to get back to specifics in a second, but I'm just interested in your own mindset approaching what we are facing at the moment, record rents and rising house prices and record homelessness. Do you believe this is a state of emergency, what we're facing at the moment?
I think certainly what we have in when it comes to our homelessness numbers, particularly when we look at homeless families, it's a crisis. It's an emergency, whatever you want to call it. Like, we have a very, very serious problem here. It's unprecedented. And that's why we're putting so much into trying to resolve this as quickly as possible. That's why we have the HUB program. That's why we'll spend over $100 million this year on emergency supports. You know, I have ambitions to increase that amount next year. There are other things that we're hoping to do to try and get these families who are in very precarious positions into safer housing or homes, even as a first response to the HUBs, and then on to more suitable permanent accommodation. And that's my priority. I also have to be mindful, though, that there are hundreds of thousands of people who at the moment can't, or they're paying the rent, but they're going way beyond what they should be doing to meet that rent, or because they're high rent, they can't afford to save for a deposit, or they're being forced to move back in with parents, and that's not ideal, or there are people who are in homes who find themselves as accidental landlords. I mean, this problem that we have is in every part of Irish society, and that's why the only real solution is to build more. And as we build more, it will relieve the different pressures in rent, people looking to buy houses, people who are in emergency accommodation because of social houses.
Okay, and as we know, that's a medium to long-term solution. It's not something that's going to happen.
20,000 homes next year is a big deal. It's a big deal.
All right, if it happens. I mean, we've heard the targets before, and we've heard the targets, seen the targets not being reached before, so we'll wait and see. You mentioned rents there, and we saw figures this week again from the CSO showing rents are up 6.6%, even though there's meant to be a cap on rents going up by 4% in the rental pressure zones. Is it working?
It is working. If you look at the inflation data for Dublin, if the trends for the first two quarters continue, inflation in the rental market in Dublin will be around 3%, maybe a little bit over. Last year, it was above 8%. So that is serious progress. If you're renting in Dublin, you'll notice that difference.
A couple of other areas have been brought into those rental pressure zones, like, for example, Greystones and Drogheda.
Yeah.
What is the point of waiting until areas hit a certain peak and then closing the door after the horse has bolted, after certain people have been priced out of the market in those areas and can no longer afford to rent? What's the point of waiting until they reach a peak? It's to protect landlords, isn't it?
Not at all. No, we have to make sure that what we do with the rent pressure zones is done on the right analysis, because while we have to make sure that we are protecting tenants, we also have to make sure that we're not disincentivizing landlords out of the market.
So it's protect landlords.
So it's not at all. We need to make sure that we have the right data in place. That's why we look at six quarters. And if you're above 7% over four of, in any of four of those six quarters, that's one of the qualifying criteria. And the second one is if the average rent then in the area is higher than the national rent in the previous quarter, then you qualify. So there are two kind of safety clauses to make sure that this has been done on an evidence base and not just because pressure has been applied by TDs or other sources.
But do you take the point, if we take Greystones as an example, which is now in the rent pressure zone, that there will be people in Greystones who over the last year or over the last couple of months since the rent pressure zones have come in, since whatever it was, last December, that in the last 9 months, they have seen rents go up and up and up in their area. They have been priced out of the market. They may have had to join the social housing list. They may have had to go homeless. They may have had to move back home. And the government didn't protect them by stopping that from happening. They waited until it happened, and now they protect people at a certain level. Those people who can afford the rents that they are at the moment, but not the people who've been already priced out of the market.
No. By bringing in the rent pressure zone as a piece of law, we've brought in a protection now for tenants.
People who can afford rents who are at this high.
All over the country, if you then qualify. But it's important to have the framework there and to have an actual qualifying criteria that is evidence-based and not based on political pressures or other problems.
Well, why not just say it all over the country? Declare the country a rent pressure zone and nobody can have their rent increased by more than 4%.
No, because in some parts of the country, rent is at an incredibly low level because historically there wasn't demand in that area.
Fine. So what? It's not going to go up anyway. So what?
But we cannot control prices in that way, because then you're actually going to then possibly stop the market completely.
Are we into ideology?
Not ideology at all. We need to make sure, like, this ideological question, we need to make sure that there's supply, that there's rental supply.
But why not control the market at a time of rental crisis, at a time when people are being forced out of their homes into homelessness? Why not control the market and say,
the controls
are
there because the landlord can't increase the rent above what's the perceived market rent or what's the known market rent at the time in the area. The rent pressure zone is a second protection that we've put in place recently.
Because the first one wasn't working.
And it is working. No, but this is better. And what we want to do with the RTB now, and what I announced at the Planning Championship, was that we would want to make it a proper regulator for the sector, to give it the powers, but also the data, so that it can then work out on each local electoral area what the average rent is based on the data it's getting, because landlords will now have to register the tenancies on an annual basis rather than per tenancy. All that information, all that data, those extra powers for the RTB are going to help it regulate the sector, so we will have fair rents, market-led rents, but also in this time of short supply, where we are seeing an exceptional increase in rents, there is that second or safety lever in the RPZs, and as areas qualify, because rents have gone up too high, according to the criteria that I outlined, then they'll go into those
zones. When people are priced out of the market. All right. You mentioned planning permission in the fast-track planning process, and people that have spoken to developers, etc., have welcomed that. They think it's very positive. They think it's going to work. But on planning permissions and what can and can't get built, do you agree with what the Taoiseach said earlier this week, that he wants to see more high-rise planning permissions, more high-rise developments, that that's the way forward in the future?
As long as it's in the right place. I think that's the key thing. I mean, one of the things that I'm conscious of is I'm dealing with this issue of getting more houses built, but I'm dealing with it in a time of crisis. So I have to find immediate solutions. But in finding those immediate solutions, I can't allow us to build in longer-term problems for our society. So when we approach things like social housing, making sure that we are including it in mixed developments, that we're not segregating different types of housing stock within one overall development that might have social mix, an affordable mix, and a private mix. And then making sure that we're building in the right areas as well, where there's actually demand to live. Mm. And we're not just satisfying a landowner's desire for profits on that land or whatever else. So it's difficult to find that balance. But I absolutely think when we look at the development of Dublin and our other cities over time, they've not developed efficiently at all. That sprawl that we all know, it chokes our infrastructure, not just our roads and our rail networks, but also obviously things like schools and hospitals and everything else. So we need to concentrate our development in and around the cities.
So perhaps one of the reasons that Dublin hasn't developed is because your cabinet colleagues in Dublin and party colleagues in Dublin have repeatedly objected to some developments in their own constituencies. We saw it from the Taoiseach. It's been in the news all last week, objecting to what was originally a four-storey building in his own constituency. Now it's then a three-storey building, still objecting to it. Mary Mitchell O'Connor didn't want four stories in her own constituency. James Riley didn't want a batch of 150 houses out in North Dublin. Shane Ross, plethora of objections to different developments in his constituency. Are you being thwarted by your own cabinet colleagues?
No, but we can't take a blanket approach to this. I can't tell you if a four-storey building in one area is good or bad. That's what the planners
decide. So a three-storey building in Castleknock, how is that out of place?
It would completely depend on the context of its setting, on whether or not there was any particular architectural protections that are there. I mean, this is the job for planners to do, okay?
Yeah, sure, and the planners did. They went in and they said this is appropriate. I'm talking about the Taoiseach's constituency.
But planners have made mistakes.
Sorry, you just said this is a job for planners to do.
Yeah, but that's why
but
we
only
have
when the Taoiseach disagrees.
No, but that's why we allow the public... Yeah, the public and also elected representatives to make observations on planning applications.
Okay, so the Taoiseach's observation...
It is part of the checks and balances in the process.
The Taoiseach's, part of the Taoiseach's observation in this particular instance was that it would devalue some of the houses around for this block. Three-storey high block of apartments, I think it's 38 apartments in Castleknock to be developed. That's 38 homes that we're talking about
in the middle of this crisis. Planning application. I haven't seen the
Taoiseach's
objections.
Do you think that it is an acceptable objection? I just want to ask you this question. Is it an acceptable objection, especially from the Taoiseach of the country, but indeed from anyone in public, but I'm asking especially for the Taoiseach of this country who's talking about a housing crisis, to object to 38 homes being built in his constituency on the basis that it would devalue the homes around it? Is that an acceptable objection?
I haven't seen the application, so I'm not going to speak to a part of it, but I trust his judgment, and I trust the judgment of my colleagues who have a role here to make sure that as we build more houses, that we are building them in the right location,
as long as
the right density and the right scale.
Other people poorer.
We have to get more houses built. What I really want to make sure is that people aren't objecting to social houses being built in their constituencies. That's an important thing that we need to see happening. We need more social housing homes, we need more affordable homes, we need more supply of houses.
And would you have confidence, Minister, that the Taoiseach wouldn't object to social houses being built in his constituency if he's objecting to not social houses, just a little complex of 38 apartments being built in his constituency? These aren't social houses. These aren't going to bring in the great unwashed, the unwanted, the people in Castleknock might be turning up their nose at.
Why are you characterising that way? I'm characterising that way because you're bringing in a complete bias into your question.
Why did you specifically mention social houses? Why would you specifically object to social houses?
Why do they object to social houses? For a whole host of reasons. But again, we shouldn't be talking about individual cases. Sarah, I'm not going to speak to what the reasons might be for why people might object to social housing.
So back to my question. Do you have confidence that the Taoiseach would not be objecting to social houses in his constituency if he is objecting to non-social houses in his constituency?
What you shouldn't be doing is trying to individualise this to individual constituencies or to individual people. We have a housing problem. We need new homes to be built.
Minister, this is not an individual person. This is the leader of the country who is out and about talking about how we should have high-rise developments, that we need to solve this housing crisis. And on the out of the other side of his mouth, in his own constituency, four votes from his own constituents, he's saying, no, don't build it here because it could devalue the houses around it. And God love those poor people who are living in their expensive houses in Castleknock.
But you characterise it as being out of the other side of his mouth. And in that, there's an implicit judgment because you assume that his own role and function as an elected member for that constituency and him as a Taoiseach, that there's somehow some sort of conflict there in terms of what we need to do as a government in the country.
You don't think there's any conflict?
We are on the same page in terms of making sure, as a cabinet, as a government, that we are getting more houses built. But elected representatives, be they councillors or TDs, whether they serve in cabinet or not, also have a function and a responsibility here to make sure that as planning and houses are built, that it is built in the appropriate way, in the appropriate place, be that social housing, be that private housing. And I'm sure that people have objected to social housing in the past, or objected to private housing, or they've objected to a supermarket or an apartment block. They have to make that judgment themselves. I trust them to make that judgment for the right reasons.
All right, just finally then, you mentioned 20,000 houses hopefully being built next year. The Fiscal Advisory Council have talked about this. The ESRI have talked about this. The idea that when you start building houses on that scale, you start running into the danger of overheating an economy because it leads to economic growth when you build houses on that scale. And even though that is needed, you need to have offsetting measures to try and stop the economy overheating. That's coming from the ESRI, the Fiscal Advisory Council. They're saying increase taxes, definitely don't decrease income taxes, increase income taxes to try and offset that overheating the economy. And yet we're hearing from Fine Gael and indeed Fianna Fáil that they're going to do the opposite. Are you at all concerned that we're running the risk of making the mistakes of the past, ignoring what the experts are telling us for political gain?
But there are other ways of offsetting risks of overheating the economy, like infrastructural investment, like actually expanding the capacity of the economy. And you do that when you build more buildings and you build more roads and other pieces of infrastructure. So at the moment, Pascal Dunne, who is reviewing the capital investment for out until 2021, and then we're going to come after that with a national development plan for our spatial and infrastructural planning for the country and a national investment plan, so the investments that will be made to make that national development plan a reality. In doing that, we will expand the capacity of our economy and we can allow it then to grow in a safe way. I mean, what we talk about growth and what we'd like to see in the economy, we would like to see somewhere between 3 and 3.5% as a kind of an average growth over a 10-year period, steady and stable, moving away from the ups and downs that we've had in the past.
Fiscal Advisory Council, ESRI, don't know what they're talking about?
No, but the Fiscal Advisory Council and the ESRI would absolutely tell you that we need to build more homes as well. So we have a job
they're
to do.
They're trying to increase taxes. You're not going to do that.
There may be some revenue-raising measures in the budget. There may be. But that's for Pascal Donoghue to do. He is the steward of the economy. I speak to him almost on a daily basis about the things that I feel I need to do, the investments I feel I need to make sure that we can meet our housing crisis. He takes that into consideration. He also takes into consideration the things we need to do in the health sector, in the education sector. Right. And together with Cabinet, we make a decision, you know, balance of judgment, and a budget will be announced and we'll know what that means for next year.
I look forward to it. Minister Owen Murphy, thank you very much for your time and for joining us this morning.
Between the Lines on Newstalk.
Now, it's the first week back for the Dáil and our TDs didn't exactly hit the ground running. After 10 weeks' holidays, they returned for just 2 days. And the Shannon didn't bother coming back at all. So, did anything of note happen in those 2 days? Were there any indications that this government is going to shed its reputation of running a do-nothing Dáil? To discuss this, we're joined now by Ellen Coyne, journalist at the Ireland edition of The Times, and also by Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant, Irish Examiner columnist, and former senior political advisor. Thank you both for joining us this morning. Gerard, I'll start with you, because one of the prominent debates that we had this week, there weren't that many of them, but one of the big ones was tax. And what sort of tax changes we're going to see in the budget. We saw a lot from Fine Gael promising to give back something to the people who pay for everything. We're hearing very strong signals from them that they want to focus on the people in the who hit the higher rate of tax. And Fianna Fáil saying, no, let's target the low to middle income earners. Brendan Howland, I thought, made a very good speech this week in the Dáil in relation to all of this, saying it was a phony debate. It's €4 up for one group, it's €2 down for the other group. What difference does it make?
It's chicken feed, and that's, you know, a remark the self-respecting fowl might object to. I mean, both proposals cost, give or take, €200 million in a year. The so-called fiscal space, which is the amount of money Pascal Donoghue has to spend on tax cuts or on new spending, is €300 million. And the amount that either would make to a person in a given week is very little. So it's really about what it says about them as political parties, and Fine Gael very anxious to demonstrate its credentials as on behalf of people who are work, squeeze middle, this is who we are for. Fianna Fáil trying to say something different about themselves, which is we're there for a much broader constituency. And it's really about the political conversation and points they're making about themselves than the difference between either proposal in terms of what it will do for you or me, which is negligible.
Okay, so the real cash doesn't matter, the policy matters and the policy direction that they're trying to take. Do you get the sense that Fianna Fáil are having their lunch eaten by Fine Gael, that perhaps they would like to go down the route of where Fine Gael has gone, but Fine Gael got there first, so Fianna Fáil, as you say, have to do something different? Or is this really what the constituency that Fine Gael is aiming at, the low to middle income earners?
Yeah, and it's also about language, I think, is hugely important, Sarah. You know, Fine Gael now, particularly under Leo Varadkar, trying to monopolise the language of opportunity, of work, getting up early in the morning. Of course, that leaves people out. It offends other people. But that's not the point. If Fine Gael, in a given opinion poll, is in the high 20s or early 30s, there is at most an extra 5 or 6 or 7% of the population that might actually, in a given election, in real time, vote for them. So they're looking to people you know, a very small group of people who might be turned on by their programmes to vote for them, and similarly for Fianna Fáil. What strikes me about Fianna Fáil in 2017 is that it's in danger of fundamentally forgetting the reason it won the election in 1997, which was an election the Rainbow government was in power. Fine Gael lost, out of office for a generation. Fine Gael, Rory Quinn was the Minister for Finance. They went in to an election with tax cuts explained, you know, on the basis of percentages that didn't really ring home in terms of, you know, simple numbers. Fianna Fáil said, no, we're giving a straightforward tax cut. Fianna Fáil now are on the back foot in terms of the conversation a little, because they're trying to explain why bringing USC down from 5% to 4% for a group who earn between approximately 18,000 and approximately 70,000 will make a difference. Whereas, and I'm already, I don't know how many words I've used saying
numbers,
that to you,
etc.
Whereas the Fine Gael offer can be put in far fewer words that are far simpler to understand.
And that comes back, Ellen, to communications again to an extent, doesn't it? And Fine Gael just getting it, maybe, as Gerard said, in the way Fianna Fáil used to get it. Get your message, get it simple and get it across.
Yeah, and I think that what's making that so clear is the fact that Fianna Fáil are putting so much effort into actually attacking Fine Gael's communications. I think Leaders' Questions had barely started on Wednesday and Timmy Dooley was firing some jive across the Dáil, saying that Leo Varadkar wasn't able to answer questions without the assistance of John Kincannon and this new strategic communications unit. At the think-in on Monday, all Micheál Martin was doing was using a variety of different questions across a whole spectrum of subjects to say, by the way, isn't Leo Varadkar spending too much time spinning? The reason these policy announcements are getting into the paper is because he actually compared him with Brexiteers, saying he says things that sound really good but actually mean nothing. So I think there is a sense of consciousness there that there's a lot of maybe younger people in the country who might take selfies with Leo Varadkar, who know who he is, but don't know a lot about their policies. And if I was Fianna Fáil, I'd be a little bit nervous about that.
So do you think their strategy is going to work then, or will it just grow old pretty fast? I mean, you can only harp on about them having this communication strategy for so long before people just start switching off.
Yeah, but the unfortunate thing is, I suppose journalists are obsessed with it. Because this strategic communications unit sounds like he's actually trying to replace us. What he said was he wanted to explain things like the budget and the capital investment plan to the public directly. And you saw this very snazzy video when...
It's banging Trump off it.
just make you like break out in a cold sweat. And they had this kind of beautiful, glossy, inspiring Twitter video when people were going back to school. And it was like, oh, isn't this a beautiful moment? By the way, the government is investing absolutely loads. So he wants to cut out us and just get straight to people saying, you know, I am Leo Varadkar and the government is absolutely super. The thing is, because journalists are so narcissistic, we're obsessed with that. So it's going to get acres and acres of column inches over the next Dáil term.
Okay, so what else is going to get column inches? Because we saw the abortion committee starting this week. What did you think of it this week? Because Catherine Noone, I know the chair, was out speaking about the work of the committee. And I just felt she got a little bit lost in trying to portray exactly what the point of the committee is. I don't know if that's just she in an interview that I heard that she just, you know, got lost herself. Or is it that she's a little worried or she's not entirely clear herself on what the point is?
I've been covering the Citizens' Assembly and the committee very, very closely. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not 100% sure how a referendum is going to happen next year. Because unless something extraordinary happens, most TDs in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael only support this mantra of rape, incest and fatal abnormality because it's politically easiest, it's the most popular. A lot of people don't have the balls, even if they wanted to go further than that. That's impossible to legislate for. And nobody has been getting that legislation ready. So no matter what happens, we're going to end up at a point next year when Leo Varadkar has to choose between a new protection of life where he puts rape victims through what suicidal women have to go through at the moment, or where he says, actually, you know, this is impossible. It is much easier on balance to just make abortion available up to 12 weeks for all women, which is exactly the process that the citizens went through. But I mean, to talk to the people of Ireland and to get TDs who aren't voting with the whip, who are voting with their conscience to support that, you'd need to be already talking to people and taking them through that, because the anti-abortion side is going to be completely justified if they're able to say that this is the thin end of the wedge and they're trying to spring this spectre of so-called abortion on demand on people. We have exactly as much time between now and early next May as the Citizens' Assembly had to come to this idea and to change their mind on what kind of abortion legislation we want. But to get to that, you'd need a Taoiseach who actually had the balls to say, you know, this is a conversation that we actually need to have. Let's get real. This rape, incest, fatal abnormality thing is popular in polls, but it's impossible to legislate for in reality.
Jared, there's no way Leo Varadkar's going to start saying that now. He's not going to say anything about this until he has to, is he?
Well, he has said something, which is that he believes that the fetus is not without rights, which I doesn't, it's not specific, but it certainly gives me a sense of part of his thinking that I wouldn't have been aware of previously. How that will translate into the text of the question that will be put before us, the people in time, remains to be seen. But the fundamental point of the committee, which is the same with the Citizens' Assembly, which is to eat up time, which is doing very successfully from a political perspective, so I can't see why anyone should be complaining about that.
The last time we had this type of committee, though, for the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill in 2013, it ate up time, yes, but it was also the focus of a lot of media and political and public debate and attention, whereas the Citizens' Assembly didn't get that. Now, obviously, it was a different type of forum and a different setup. Do you think the committee will get it this time
around? No, I'm sure it won't. And that's not to say there's not going to be a lot of coverage about abortion in the media, but the committee getting coverage and the detail and the nuance of people's contributions getting coverage, I would say, is between slim and nil. And most of that sort of detail from the Citizens' Assembly was never translated or wouldn't be widely appreciated or known outside of it. So how a referendum will work is the same as every other one. Eventually, the elected government of the country will make a decision on what the text of the question will be. Second thing is that we, the people, will have a period of time to consider it. And the intense discussion and consideration will only take place in a very few short weeks prior to polling day. And it will be all telescoped into that time, and that will be it. And there will be no other debate.
Is that dangerous, do you think, in terms of a question that is as complicated as this? Like Ellen's point that we need to start the conversation
now. But this is
now.
The whole point, Sarah, about having referenda on very complex issues. It's entirely inappropriate that such complex issues, whatever the subject of constitutional referenda, the idea that you can encapsulate in a sentence or two in a constitution the necessary nuance, regardless of what perspective you come from, is simply wrong. And that is the fatal flaw of the Eighth Amendment, which, of course, from the point of view of those who advocated for it, completely failed because of the Supreme Court judgment in the X case, which they blamed everyone else for except themselves, its proponents and authors.
Just in relation to buy-in on this point, finally, Ellen, I mean, the public isn't buying in yet because, as Jared has outlined, it's very far away. It's not going to happen probably until the weeks before an actual referendum is called. Have the members of the Oireachtas bought in, do you think, who are on this committee? Because there was so much debate over who was going to be on the committee, who wasn't, would they be rotating, etc. And some allegations this week that some people on the committee hadn't even read the full text of the Citizens' Assembly report.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some really, really superb women TDs on the committee who are really, really impressive. But it was incredibly frustrating, just as somebody who spent a lot of time covering the Citizens' Assembly, to see very basic questions come up again. And I think that's because when the result came out, because we hadn't been paying attention to it, a lot of political commentators dismissed the members of the Assembly as some sort of deranged socialists who were advocating for this crazy law, when actually the Citizens' Assembly had a conversation about abortion that we've never succeeded in having in the media and politics in Ireland before. So politicians are coming to this new. And the thing is, while the Citizens' Assembly successfully took the heat out of it, there is people going in now, be they kind of fair weather feminists who see that this issue is getting a lot of coverage now, or people who want to take a lot of credit, who will eat up a lot of the committee time posturing and kind of willy waving and that sort of thing, rather than actually getting to the issue itself. And I think that that's a shame. I think politicians would have been a lot better served if they'd paid close attention to the committee when it was actually happening, considering all of them voted for it to be set up in the first place.
Just finally then, Jared, on the allegation of the do-nothing doll, do you think the government is likely to be able to shed that in the coming term, or will it do anything to shed it?
Well, the do-nothing doll, rather like your introduction, Sarah, about the long holidays, I think both are misnomers. Very few TDs are on holidays while the doll is in recess. And I think people who cover...
Some are.
I disagree.
Okay.
And I think people who cover politics largely know better.
I think some are, some aren't, Jared. I think some work very hard during the holidays. I think some kick back in their constituencies and kick up their feet.
Yeah, but the idea that politics has stopped because the doll is...
Okay, I'll accept that.
In relation to the do-nothing doll, it's certainly a lot less productive in terms of legislation, but that is precisely in line with the democratic decision of which we the people took. We didn't take a decision to empower one political party over another. We voted for a situation where, you know, there's only this very delicate balance, where only very few things can be done, provided that there's a wide spectrum of agreement. That's what we decided. So we are the do-nothing electorate. And visiting that then on politicians, together with their long holidays, it's not logical and doesn't make sense.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because they could have made different decisions after the election to form a different type of government that wouldn't have been as powerless as this
government is. They couldn't have done that, Sarah, unless they were prepared to break the promises they made to us.
But we've seen that how many times?
So now we're appalled that they did it again. Or didn't do it this time, I should say. I beg your pardon.
Well, I'm just saying they had choices.
They did have choices, and in relation to the choices they made, I suppose...
I mean, they could have, I think, come out and explained to the electorate, none of us anticipated this result.
Correct.
And therefore, because of the promises that we made were not made in anticipation of this result, absolutely, we're very, very sorry, we hold up our hands,
yeah,
but for the good of the country, we think stability is more important, and we're going to therefore have a grand Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael coalition, or go into coalition with Sinn Féin, whatever it might be.
Those were all options, and personally, I'm deeply relieved there wasn't a grand coalition. I think this, you know, very limited capacity to do in this Dáil, you know, is not a bad thing in the sense that it locks in a capacity of a majority government to be put under pressure in an economic recovery and make spending decisions that wouldn't be prudent over the long term. Because the experience of the boom is that actually it's far more difficult to manage a recovery than it is to manage a downturn. The pressures accumulate.
Mm.
And actually, this do-nothing Dáil, you know, is a lock, if you like, on over-exuberance or on foolishness.
Ellen, I'll give the final word to you on this. What are you looking forward to, or what do you think is going to be the standout thing of this next term?
Because I am covering it, I'm particularly focused on how the government gets through this abortion committee, how Simon Harris starts drafting legislation, and also Simon Harris himself is talking about some really interesting things, whether it's regulating crisis pregnancy agencies or this move to separate church and state, which followed the National Maternity Hospital last year. I think that was kind of, it went a little bit underground during the summer, but I think that that's actually going to be a huge moment for the state, where you're talking about actually taking religion out of healthcare for the first time ever. And it's something that he just decided to pick up himself. This is somebody who was a staunchly pro-life TD, I think, in 2011. And I think that there's going to be some really interesting stuff coming out of both the Department of Health and Children and Youth Affairs from Catherine Sapone for the same reason.
And indeed, education. We saw with the educational training boards last week that they're saying that they don't want to have religious education in school time. They're not going to provide it starting from now. So yeah, lots of changes in that regard. Ellen Coyne, journalist at the Ireland edition of The Times, and Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant, Irish Examiner columnist, and also former senior political advisor. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Between the Lines on Newstalk.
Naomi McElroy, entertainment reporter with The Star, is here to talk us through the week's celebrity, culture and media matters. Good morning, Naomi.
Good morning, Sarah.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. So what has caught your interest this week? What are you looking at?
Well, for me, the main thing that caught my interest was Beyoncé's posterior. I think it's the plot.
Doesn't it always?
Well, I know. But more so than ever this week. As we all know, Beyoncé recently gave birth to the most famous twins in the history of time. And she has done that thing that I kind of slightly hate when famous women do of, I will drop out of, you know, the face of publicity and the press and go away. And I presume a combination of starve and exercise my body into submission. And she unveiled herself this week in extremely tight pink pants, doing the whole, you know, standing with her back to the camera, smouldering over one shoulder. You know, I am the woman who invented the word bootylicious, after all, as her whole, I have lost all the weight after pregnancy.
Mm.
And this is something that is kind of everywhere at the moment. I mean, like, she had those twins 2 months ago. 2 months is not a long time. She's 36, you know. I mean, it's obviously harder to lose the weight when you're a little bit older. Cheryl recently, she had Bear, terrible
Cheryl
name.
Cole, no Cheryl longer Cole, called
yes,
Cole.
No longer called Cole. She's just Cheryl these days. She only needs one name like Madonna or Cher. She had Bear. Now, she took 5 months. But how she unveiled her post-pregnancy figure was even more dramatic. It was in like a little crop top and really low cut, actually really low cut trousers you would love. They were beautiful in orange. But she unveiled basically her abs.
And like they, a real
oh,
stick
abs
it to you.
You could grate cheese on, you know. Nothing has changed. In fact, if anything, I am better than ever. And when Cheryl did this, this is about maybe a week ago. Do you know Binky Felsted? She's from one of the Made in Chelsea girls.
Oh, yes.
She also recently had a baby. Now, her child is called India, slightly more normal name. She came out and said that Cheryl was, you know, it was too in your face with these abs, beautiful abs everywhere. And it wasn't real life. And, you know, really, she shouldn't be doing it. But she herself did the exact same thing 7 weeks after having her child. Now, she is younger again, so again, it's easier for her to bounce back. But she did a picture of herself on Instagram in like a little top and, you know, a fitness gear, really, a little crop top and pants. And I suppose it's this whole, it's an industry now of, if you're a woman who is famous and has had a baby, the minute the child is lifted out of you, the clock is ticking for you to immediately, I mean, you know the way that they do tell you when you have a baby that you should always be doing your kind of internal exercises and you should start
Kegels
your Kegels. Yeah. And at the minute the child is born, you should start doing them. I mean, you know, all those people need a slap, to be honest. But it's almost as if these women do that, but with sit-ups. You know, they're straight away back on the treadmill, trying to get themselves looking even better again, and then for a kind of a grand unveiling.
But who are the victims here then? Okay, so they're doing it, and I hate that they're doing it.
Me and you.
Yeah.
Ordinary women are the victims.
Are we though, or are they the victims? Because when they don't do it, are they not lambasted? Because I remember Kate Middleton, after she had her first baby, George, and she came out of the hospital. Now, you talk about the clock ticking. She's literally walking straight out from the hospital. This is hours after having her baby. And she's wearing this polka dot blue dress with white spots. Do you remember it? And she's holding her beautiful newborn baby up to her chest. And however she was holding him, it made her postpartum bump more obvious under her dress. So you could see that she still had a little bump. Because, you know, she just had a small human being inside her like 12 hours previously. And that's what the focus was on. The focus was on... I saw something, I think, at the time on Twitter. I don't know where I saw it, but I remember seeing a comment, does she have another baby in there? I remember seeing that comment at the time. But that's what the focus was on, the fact that she still had a bump. So that's the pressure we're putting these women under. So maybe they're the victims, that they have to. I mean, who wants that?
But it's a vicious circle, because that's what enables the entire thing to continue. The reason the that pressure is there is because so many of these famous women literally vanished from sight. I mean, this is not a new thing. Remember when Liz Hurley had her son Damien? I mean, this was hilarious. She went and hid in Elton John's house for 4 months. No one saw her. And she went undercover with Elton John. I mean, I can just imagine the fun
four
times.
4 months.
They
she
had
a bit tardy.
And was constantly working out, and then unveiled herself in a bikini at the end of the 4 months. But like, it's that level of secrecy of no one can even see me. So people don't see them, except for obviously Kate Middleton was seen. I suppose people are surprised then, because we're not used to seeing a woman who, in the public eye, who has had a baby, emerging from hospital with still, you know, an obvious deflated bump. And you and I have both have had children. We both know that that is the way it goes. As a result of which, I have to say, I brought my normal jeans into hospital. I thought I would be able to have my child and put my normal jeans back on. I was crying.
Because that's what you see in the media.
I can't blame the media. I was 21 and quite stupid. Okay. But I was convinced, I suppose, because that's what I had picked up that would happen.
You have a baby, your body goes back to normal immediately.
And I didn't have anything else to wear home. And I was there trying to force my normal jeans onto myself, crying while my child lay beside me in her little...
Okay, so that's you. But then imagine being... sorry to go back to Kate Middleton, but I just happened to see pictures of her recently with her second baby, the little girl whose name I can't remember. But she came out of the hospital with her. She was wearing heels. 12 hours after having her baby, she was wearing heels.
And I'm sure a lot
Can you imagine somebody telling you to put on a pair of heels and walk out of a hospital after 12 hours after having a baby?
I'm sure a lot of people...
And she'd had her hair done. Can you imagine anything worse than sitting in a hospital after having your baby with a hairdresser, like blowing hot air around your head? I actually do see her as a victim, that she feels the need to do all of that in order to not get the type of criticism she got with George.
But the reason that she gets that criticism is because the way that all of society is. I'm sorry to
But
bang
is that not
on.
Our fault rather than their fault? Because we
it's
are loading these expectations
on them.
Everybody's
fault. It's everybody's fault who, from the minute a girl is born, teaches us that the most important thing about herself is what she looks like. Mm. It's all part of that same thing. I mean, look at, this is a terrible example, but look at Tori Spelling. Tori Spelling.
I haven't looked at Tori Spelling in quite a while.
I don't really think anyone particularly likes your poor Tori Spelling. She went a bit crazy with the plastic surgery. But anyway, Tori Spelling has 4 children by her husband, who left his wife that he had 2 children by for Tori Spelling when he met her and started having an affair with her. 2 of her children are 9 months apart. Literally 9 months apart. Oh. She had an extremely stressful delivery with one of them and was like, announced that she was pregnant again 6 weeks, I think it was, after giving birth to the child. And when asked, Tori, do you not think this was a bit much, really? She said, I didn't want him to think that the sex had gone off.
Oh.
And what happened? He, when child number 4 was born, had an affair because she was apparently spending all her time and attention on the children and none of it on him. So it's all this pressure that, you know, you can say, like, society puts women under, women put themselves under. it's a huge amount of
pressure. Okay, so I'm half with you on it. I suppose I just for most women in the media, most celebrities, I just wouldn't have an expectation that they'd be able to stand up to that pressure and own it and just say, this is what I look like after having a child or two children, and this is what most women look like. I am very disappointed in Beyoncé, because I think she could own it. And she has the personality, she has the charisma to just get out there and own it. And she could have done it for all of us. And she didn't.
And she has so many fans and she's so influential, especially in the lives of young girls. You know, I mean, me and you both love her. But like, imagine how we would feel about her if we were 15, you know. Mm. I mean, she's really, really, she's got a lot of power. And she could be using it to say...
She can use her power for good.
No, she almost used her power for evil. She's gone to the dark side. Oh, Beyonce, why? Why have you done this?
Who would have
thought
a pair of tight pink jeans could be so much controversy? You've gone to the dark side, Beyonce. All right, someone else who is living in the dark side most of her life, Lady Gaga. Her documentary's coming up?
Her documentary would have dropped yesterday on Friday on Netflix. And anyone out there who's a Lady Gaga fan, as again, both of us are, you have to watch this. Really, the documentary, it isn't even so much about Lady Gaga. It's about Stephanie, I'm going to say her surname wrong, Giamucci.
Oh yes, well done. Lady Gaga's real name.
Lady Gaga's real name.
Might not be a fan.
It's all about the real person. Like, anyone who likes Lady Gaga will know she always wears enormous shoes. You know, she's all about the crazy makeup and the, you know, meat dresses and hats with telephones on. The documentary is called 5'2", because that's how tall she really is. And it's all about the actual human who is in there underneath all the crazy outfits. That's both bad and good. The thing that's slightly disappointing about it, it was made while she was filming her most recent album, Joanne, which was kind of a flop because she went all country and western.
Oh,
yeah.
I missed that.
Yeah, it was very kind of Bruce Springsteen, but much more to the kind of country side of it. It was not what people who expect her to come out riding a unicorn that shoots glitter out of his horn want or expect in their music. But despite that, the music is very much kept to a minimum in it, which is good because it's, you know, not as good as her actually good songs. And
so is that music sort of the soundtrack to the documentary?
Not really. There's only about maybe 2-3 musical numbers in the whole thing. Okay. It's very much kept to a minimum. It's much more about her as a person. And it's obviously all these documentaries try and pass themselves off as, you know, unflinchingly honest. But with this one, you do get the feeling that it really is. I mean, you see her relationship to Taylor Kinsey, who she was going to marry, basically break down on camera. You see her in intense pain because she suffers from this chronic pain condition. You see her worrying before meeting her fans because she's not all done up and she's like, what if they don't like me when I don't have all the makeup and glitter? You see her vowing revenge on Madonna because Madonna has slagged her off, and she goes into this mafia-esque kind of rant, you know, I'm Italian and from New York and so is she. She couldn't say this to my face.
What did Madonna say?
Madonna said that, like, she was, you know, tired and old hat and copying off her in the first place. Hmm. And Lady Gaga's not having that. And she's, like, very
dead
much
right,
threatening that she's going to smack Madonna down.
Let's have a listen. We have a clip from the documentary, as Naomi said. It was released on Netflix yesterday. Let's have a listen.
But, like, I'm alone, Brandon, every night. And all these people will leave. Right? They will leave. And then I'll be alone. And I go from everyone touching me all day and talking at me all day to total silence.
That's a clip there of Lady Gaga talking about how when her success is going well or when her career is going well, she sells 10 million albums. And one relationship breaks down, she sells 20 million albums. The next relationship breaks down, that there's always a payoff or a trade-off.
Yeah.
She can't have everything. And then at the end of the day, as you heard in the clip there, she's talking about how she's alone. You know, she's all these people touching her, talking to her, wanting a bit of her all day. And then she gets home and she's in a house on her own
with her success. Always tends to happen with these famous people who are like massive icons who are really adored by their fans. It just seems to go hand in hand. Army of completely devoted, adoring fans. You know, you go home, you shut the door, you're in your house all by yourself. And like I was saying, it is very, like, it's not all as depressing and sad as that clip did sound, but I mean, it is very close to the bone. I mean, you can't fake that whole kind of tone in your voice when you're crying, you know. I mean, your heart would go out to her. But again, there's lots of upbeat stuff in it as well.
Do we learn anything about Lady Gaga?
I think so. I mean, she was always kind of a bit easy to dismiss before as somebody who, I suppose, couldn't even really be hurt because she had so many different masks, you know. Whereas in this, you really see her as an actual human being who puts on their jeans one leg at a time, the same as you or me. I mean, and there's a lot of kind of as well about the acting side of it. I don't know if you've seen her in American Horror Story, which she's actually excellent in as well. But I suppose it says a lot too about the whole kind of the whole kind of idea of fame, that you don't really think that a person is a human being anymore when they hit that level of famous. You know, I've been to see her in concert. Like, I love her. I think she's amazing. But I kind of find it very hard to reconcile the person I saw on stage and screamed along for with then that idea of somebody who just is alone in their house, moping around by themselves.
Because she talks about the Super Bowl as well, doesn't she, and performing at the Super Bowl.
All the build-up to the Super Bowl is in it, which is really good and really, like, really interesting to watch.
And she has these sort of conflicted feelings about it, because this is going to be the biggest thing as she sees it. Where do I go from here?
And also, because she's kind of trying to promote her new album, Joanne, which is this whole very kind of country vibe. She thinks she's kind of going to be upsetting her fans or letting them down. Or she talks at one point about, like, oh, people just want me to be carried out by like 10 naked men, you know, wearing meat underpants.
That's true.
Yes. Dressed, you know, with unicorn horns. And like when she said that, I was like, oh my God, why didn't you do that? It would have been brilliant.
That's the Lady Gaga we know and love.
That is also the problem. Like, I always loved her kind of crazy flamboyance. But if you love a person, you have to really love them.
Maybe asking too much. However, if you don't like Lady Gaga, would you still recommend watching it?
I would, but maybe I'm slightly tainted by the fact that I really like her. I think everyone who watches this will kind of come away from it going, wow, it's a really interesting insight into, like, fame and just what life is like for kind of a young woman. Like, a lot of the time she's just a girl as well, isn't it? You know, you really feel for her.
All right, Naomi McElroy, thank you so much for joining us again this morning. And that is it from me today. My thanks to the production team, Aidan McKelvey and Stephen Jordan. I'll be back next Saturday at 8 a.m.